I'm David Halpin. I'm a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon, now in my 86th year. I'm quite well known for having chartered with Sue a vessel, Barbara, to go to Gaza on the 1st of February 2003. We had 50 tons of stuff in the hold, including 40 tons of organic flour, and we were going to show our common humanity with people being trodden down in Palestine, and also to cry against the looming war on Iraq, not with Iraq, on Iraq, based on the lie that that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which we certainly have. So that's a brief summary.
As we speak, there is a horrific imposed famine, starvation going on. What was it that, I mean, because this is going back, even in the 1990s, it seems to me you were aware that this was a potential disaster zone in Gaza. So what was it that made you focus on that? Because it's quite a big thing to do, to charter a boat to get aid in yourself as a private individual.
Well, the total cost to us, in fact, was finally, when we set up the charity, was £140,000. We'd sold a larger house to scale down, and we had some money in the kitty. And I don't regret one penny of that. I was operating with a Palestinian senior health officer at Tor Bay in perhaps about 1984. And I was closing up an operation, and Abu Lafi, I think his name was, said to me, "Mr. Halpin, do you know what they're doing to us in Palestine?" I said, "I have a fair idea, Abu Lafi." He said, "You have no idea. No idea." But I was very busy doing a job with a lot of people to look after, often with very serious conditions. And so I was too occupied to get involved deeply in Palestine. But I was stimulated when we set upon the people of Afghanistan in October of 2001 in response to the lie that Osama bin Laden, the Wraith as I call him, had got the 9/11 cataclysm going, a cinematographic exercise in New York and at the Pentagon.
And well, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? Because we were told the next day who was responsible,
yes,
for it.
Exactly. No, it was quite obviously a construct to start a war on Islam with every excuse. And that's what happened. So we were, in fact, crying against that. And as we set off on the 1st of February, and when we then went into the Mediterranean at about the 6th of February 2003, and as we then steamed eastwards towards Palestine, skirting Cyprus, our ship, the officer of the watch, either Captain Hestoy, Heine Hestoy, or the mate, they were interviewed five times by either fixed-wing aircraft or helicopters, I think mostly based at Akrotiri in Cyprus. It was quite obvious that 6 weeks before the Iraq war, they'd thrown a vast cordon across the Eastern Mediterranean to make sure that anyone was, any other ship coming in, had only the intention of setting upon Iraq like wolves, to quote Galloway. So that gave you the thing. So in that last day before we hove to off Ashdod, in the last 2 days, we're interviewed on one day five times. That gives you some idea of the amount of military input already there.
Yeah. So what was the connection between Gaza and Iraq?
Iraq, Hussein had had done his best to help the Palestinians, unlike some other Arab countries. He'd taken in medical students free of charge to the medical schools in Iraq. He was, I think, a bastion in the Arab world for Palestine. People deny that, but there's good evidence for that. So there was no question about that. And the key thing is this. a tract written in Hebrew by Oded Yinon, Y-I-N-O-N, is crucial. It was translated by an atheist Israeli, ex-Poland, called Israel Shehak, into English. And that has to be read. It's easily found online. Global Research has it in its files. And in that tract, Oded Yinon described how Israel would eliminate every Arab entity or nation, often using tribal divide, and the first country to be erased was Iraq. The second was Syria, and I think the third was Libya.
This reminds me of what the Americans were talking about around about the time of 9/11, getting rid of seven countries in 5 years. So this sounds to me as if it's a plan, American stroke Israeli plan. Who actually authored this? Is it Americans doing what the Israelis want, or the other way around?
No, it's the Israelis leading it with their idea of Eretz Israel, an Israel extending, to quote, from the brook of the Nile to the Euphrates. It was a large tract of land, and in fact, if you hear what they're saying in recent years, it's more obvious that it's not just that large chunk of the Middle East with its oil-bearing land. It's also, in fact, larger. If you read people like Hariri, I'm yet to do that, actually. Joe's given me the book. But they have they think they're the modern gods. They think that they have the skills, the intellect, and the ability, the managerial ability, to manage the world.
So what was going on in Gaza at the time that you were, because you left us off the coast.
Yes.
Maybe you could explain a bit about the, you know, what had been going on in Gaza, and then explain what happened with the ship.
Well, every so often, the fact is, I describe what is happening, has happened since the 10th of October, the Israeli response to the raid, the breaking out on the 7th of October, 2023. I describe it as an holocaust, as Susan Abul-Hawa has in the States, a professor, a very eloquent Palestinian, a granddaughter of refugees from 1948. The genocide started in 1948 with all determination. It was already going, in fact, before 48. But they were shooting hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians down to the age of 12 in the villages that they were taking. And then they had the older men bury the dead, the men that they'd shot from ages of 12 upwards, whilst their mothers and wives watched them being buried. Read Ilan Pappe's The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. When we arrived, I knew what was happening in Gaza before I went there. That's why I was motivated to go there, to share our common humanity, and as a doctor, to see what was going on.
So what happened with the ship?
With the ship, we had to hove to. There was a westerly gale going when we arrived. We had to anchor off with other ships before entering the port of Ashdod, which faces west. And we were, in fact, anchored quite close to an oil rig with its lights on. And that just reminds me, to say that there is gas, there are rich gas and oil fields off the coast of Palestine, which is part of the motivation for the Israelis wishing to make quite sure that the Palestinians are ethnically cleansed completely, so that they have the rich resources there, including north of there in the Levantine Trench.
So did you manage to get into the port?
We got into the port. Next day, we spent the stevedores in the port, cleared the hold quite quickly, but then I spent most of the day having money wired from this country to then called Israel. I call it Palestine all the time, of course, but they made all sorts of charges. I had to find £4,000 for the work done on the port and other things as well. They wanted $700. It's in the film Eyes Open Gaza, 20 minutes, which tells you a good deal about our visit to Gaza then and the voyage. We had to find $700 so they could test the cheese to make sure it was safe for the people that they wanted to kill and crush. You couldn't make it up, Tony. We got into Gaza. There were four trailer lorries taking all our cargo down to Kane, where there was an area where they offload the produce onto a concrete platform, then Palestinian vehicles and forklift trucks, then load the lorries. So we got down. That was happening in parallel. We went down as passengers in taxis. And during our 4 days in Gaza, we were taken around down to Rafah. The two older Britons, John Hingley and John Maugham, wept several times at what they had to see, because Gaza was being subjected to recurrent smaller holocausts, in Hebrew, Shoahs, S-H-O-A-H. And what we saw there in the film, we film Khan Yunis, which is often featured now in the massacres that are going on almost every day. And Khan Yunis, I said, looked like Warsaw, 1943.
Well, you're saying that there's these massacres going. What was actually happening? Can you go into some detail? What did you say?
I'll give you one example. In the film, it shows you a cage hoisted up on a large crane. They installed snipers in that with their sandwiches and coffee, Hessian around it to screen them, and they would take pot shots at anybody, what child, mother, or man, as they desired. They were crushing buildings, bombing things. If you look at it, it was, in Rafah particularly, the destruction was very extensive. That was 2003.
So anyway, right as we're speaking this week, there's another boat heading, small ship, heading for Gaza with supplies. Sitting on it, apparently, so we're told, is the famous Swedish environmental activist Greta Thunberg.
Yes.
The whole situation, how do you think they're going to get on?
It's being tailed, apparently, by an Israeli drone, so I saw it read this morning. And the previous vessel they had, which I think it did, in fact, moor in Malta, not quite certain about that, but they were about 60 miles off the coast of Malta when two missiles struck the deck of the vessel that they were using previously. There could have been loss of life or loss of limb. There were heat-seeking missiles, by my analysis, and it focused on on the generator on the deck of this vessel that they had. So they've obviously found another vessel. They sailed this time from Italy, but they're being tailed, and they are being threatened with destruction by the Israeli High Command. Just as we were in our vessel, the Dignity, on the 30th of December 2008, when they rammed us at 5:30 in the morning in a very stiff sea and in the dark. Three gunboats, 66 miles off the coast of Palestine. They wanted to drown all 16 of us. So that was one of my near escapes. I thought I'd had it, actually. But I've also been poisoned previously in Gaza, I'm quite certain, at Zionist command.
What we're witnessing now, the whole world is holding up its hands and saying this cannot be allowed to happen, which is the mass starvation. Now, you mentioned something to do with the oil fields. I mean, the Israelis could quite easily go there, grab the oil fields, start drilling oil. They wouldn't even really have to pay the Palestinians a penny for it, and the Palestinians could do nothing about it. This has got much more to do, surely, with controlling resources. There's no need to eliminate all these people. They could carry on and take those resources without doing that.
They want to eliminate the people. That has been in them. If you've been born into an Ashkenazim. I want to make this distinction. 80% of the Israeli Jewish, inverted commas, population are Ashkenazim, and they recognize it themselves. They call them Ashkenazim. These people have no genetic connection with any of those tribes among many that lived in those fertile lands in what we now call Palestine, or more widely in the Fertile Crescent.
So it's there is no right to return for someone who's never been.
Right, the whole thing is a lie. The aliyah, which is the right to return to any Jew, inverted commas, I always put it with a small j, I don't like racial labels anyway, but
Judaism is a religion. Really, it's not a race, is it? Or is it both? It seems that people feel they can pick and choose.
Yeah, they pick and choose. About 5 years ago, the Knesset decided, they passed a statute which now calls Israel the Jewish state. But what they've done is to conflate the religion of Jewishness
Judaism.
They've conflated it with an ideology, a Zionist ideology. So now, you know, international that IHRA does exactly that by call anyone who criticizes Israel. They can then in fact say that you're being anti-Semitic. The whole thing is a terrible lie. But the basis of this is that infant is made to think it is chosen, as against being one of the others, Gentiles or Goyim or other names that sometimes, in fact, in Yiddish, in the Yiddish dialect, we are people who are not, inverted commas, Jewish, are dismissed as being the other, a Gentile or Goyim. It is an extraordinary racist imprinting on an infant, and that is a big factor.
Well, didn't the British Empire do this?
Of course.
Right the way up until World War II, really. Yeah. It was like anybody that's not part of the British Empire is some sort of fuzzy-wuzzy.
No, look at the way we treated the Irish. We regarded the Irish as, just as the Israelis regard the Palestinians, the Arabs as they call them, they regard them as being Untermenschen, not under people, but Untermenschen people.
Well, they are certainly treating them like animals. What we've seen this week is the idea of almost putting aid like rat bait,
yes,
so that
exactly,
as they come for the bait, they're then shot and killed.
Well, the other day, when there was the first exercise near Rafah, that was chosen, of course, because they could then drive them across the border if the Egyptians, who are complicit with the Israelis at government level, they would have been able to drive them across in their terror.
They can't get out. They can't get through the border.
They can't get
without,
out.
Without, I think, isn't it about £3,000 or £5,000?
Exactly. That's what I'm hearing, that they have to pay bounties of, bribes of about $5,000 to get through. We've been all through that. I've seen it with Sue when we had to go there in 2011 through Rafah. But there were scenes then, as you know, of thousands of people streaming towards the food that they were putting there as rat bait, as you say, and they're being shot in the head and chest as they did so. One massacre has been filmed quite widely and shown worldwide. But I would like to tell your audience, Tony, of the family of Dr. Al-Najjar. She was working at the Nasser Hospital as a paediatrician. She had 10 children, all down to the age of, I think, just about 3 years of age, I think. The eldest in its early teens. And she was in the hospital when they brought in 9 of her children. Some of them were charred beyond recognition. She couldn't identify them. But they had missiled her house with her husband there inside it. He is, in fact, I think he's surviving, but he's very badly burned and injured in other ways by fractures. That would have been a Hellfire missile, a thermobaric weapon, which has a temperature of about 3,000 degrees centigrade at the peak of this explosion. There's a second explosion, which causes a tremendous blast and, in fact, will break bones and also fracture livers and spleens inside the tummy without obvious external injury. We're dealing with demonic action, satanic action, beyond imagining. They are terrorizing the whole world. But, Tony, I write in hope. They are falling apart. They're leaving Israel in big numbers. The missiles that the Yemenis are sending now and again to Ben Gurion Airport, they cause the flights to stop. They have to go circling. And the sirens sound all around Israel, apparently. And thousands and thousands then flee for their lives. They are losing their morale. There's a great deal of psychological illness there. And I think within months, they will be gone. Back to Brooklyn.
Well, you are a retired surgeon and a pathologist. How do you think you would be able to cope with working in one of the devastated hospitals now in Gaza?
I would find it very difficult, Tony, but resilience and injury.
What are the sort of things that you have to perform your work? Because much of the supplies are simply medical. So we think of food and water, this sort of thing, but actually medical supplies, without that, it's very difficult to even to give medical aid to people who've been injured. Even some fairly potentially simple procedures cannot be done because you don't have the medical supplies to do.
No, well, the thing, we need light, so you need electricity. You need light, you need calm, you need anaesthetist, you need drugs, you need antiseptics, you need good instruments, you need a building which is safe and secure and sterile when you're operating. They have the opposite. They often have no light, they have no anaesthetics. We've read about thousands of children having amputations without anaesthetic. Tony, you couldn't. What we're seeing now is the Holocaust that affected mostly people of so-called Jewish origin, Ashkenazim, in fact, mostly, in the Second World War under the Nazi regime, and along with Slavs and communists and socialists that they were corralling in, and Roma, of course. We're sealing that Holocaust now with the most modern weapons, most evil weapons, happening in great speed and streamed worldwide. The world is being terrorized as a world by these people.
But the Israelis get very annoyed when people compare what's going on now to the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews. But there is a very strong evidence that the Nazis were cooperating with the Zionists to transport and help leave Germany any Jews that wished to go to Palestine, that sort of started to buy into this whole idea of Zionism. So before the war began in the late 1930s, this was going on, wasn't it? The Nazis were saying, well, we don't really like you Jews here, but we're quite happy to help you go to Palestine. So what ended up in the Holocaust, the individuals there were the ones that were the non-Zionist Jews.
Yes. Exactly. Well, a lot of them, in fact, were anti-Zionists. A lot of the Polish Jews, inverted commas Jews, were apparently not, they were not enamoured by the Zionist ideal at all. And a good example of that was Hedy Epstein, who became a very good friend. She died about 3 years ago. She was a wonderful lady. Her parents died in the Nazi Holocaust, but she was one of a family in a so-called shtetl. They were anti-Zionists, but most of the people in the shtetl were apparently pro-Zionists, according to Hedy. She saw it all, and she was treated abominably by the Israeli authorities when she went to Israel several times, the last time particularly. But you're quite right, Tony, that there was, generally speaking, not much adherence amongst the Jewish population of Europe for Zionism. And certainly in Palestine itself, the Jews who were resident there, who were probably descended way, way back from Jewish people in Palestine.
Well, they tended to be kind of coffee-coloured skinned, didn't they?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but they certainly were not. They were not keen on what the Zionists in Europe were imposing on Palestine. That's the fact of it.
Well, maybe I'm talking about the Yemeni Jews. But Hedy, what was in her mind? What was it that... Why did she object to this whole idea of going back to Jerusalem?
Well, Hedy was a stenographer and witness at the Nuremberg trials. She'd seen it all. But she then saw what the Zionists were doing in Palestine, the native people. And she was a kindly human, very lovely person. I got to know her well, actually, and she respected me. And she saw the evil of them, and she spoke against it with absolute clarity. Hedy, H-E-D-I, Epstein. I feel that I was very honoured to have met her. But you know, Tony...
So she'd picked that up from her parents, had she?
Yes, she had, actually. And that's so important. I say that when I see someone who's so obviously, who radiates goodness, I always think of how they became so, and that's usually because of their upbringing, their mum and dad. And she obviously had a good mum and dad who were analytical in their minds and had good hearts. They were universalists like I am. I don't regard race as important at all. At all. One has to see the nuances of that, actually, how people are brought up. But I look at every person as an individual, and I look at their eyes, because through their eyes you can see their soul. And people who are patently good and honest, it shines out in them. And the people who are what I would call shysters, or people of evil intent, it is so obvious. So if you look into Blair's eyes, you can see what he is. He's the paramount psychopath and war criminal, and he will eventually be held up in the bar, the wrong side of the bar for him, being a barrister, at Nuremberg too. I keep calling for that. The Netanyahu's and the Bush's and the Blair's and all the rest of them.
But he's not going to be, is he? He's not, because we have a very strong establishment in this country. It's quite clear that they are supporting the Israelis. They're doing everything they can. They're bending over backwards to support them. In fact, the Israel lobby in Britain is extremely strong. It's very strong in the press as well. And I just wondered if you could tell us what you make of the sort of home front. So how the Israeli tentacles are reaching here into Britain and manipulating the establishment. Because Tony Blair obviously should be in jail, but he's not going to be because
He will be. I'll tell you why. Because the Palestinians in Gaza particularly, but also in Jenin and places like that in the West Bank, so-called West Bank, they're making the ultimate sacrifice, that is of their lives and their limbs, sometimes their minds, to show the world the depth of evil of the Zionists and the other racist and fascist nations of the West. You know very well that the European nations are mostly behind what is happening in Gaza.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think the people of those nations are not behind
the people,
it, but the governments and particularly Brussels are behind
it. That's what I'm saying. The leaderships are with the Zionists, no question. And what is happening now is that as the revulsion grows worldwide, in spite of the absence of any proper reporting in the institutional media, in the BBC, etc., in spite of that, particularly through the social media platforms, people are seeing the reality in Palestine. And they will realize that their governments are bankrupt morally and that they are to be deposed. And what will happen? There will be a revolution of the mind that I've been yearning for years, and we will end up with leaderships which mean something and which have good intentions from the word go. You were talking last night about the politicians you'd like to see. The people, not politicians, people like Bridgen, people of principle, becoming leaders again. It'll happen.
Well, I'm not so sure, because I'd like you to talk now about where you see the... I mean, we've got, for example, the campaign against anti-Semitism taking a whole bunch of people to court, I think it's just over the last couple of weeks, as anti-Semitic, using British laws to silence and to tie up and to cost large amounts of money to those people who are the most vehement and intelligent supporters of Palestine. So there are all sorts of elements in this part of the world which are being used in order to support the genocide, and that's just one example.
Well, the thing is that that's happening, but there's I don't like the word pushback, but there is growing resistance to that, and I think that the power of that is being diminished daily by what is being broadcast outside the main media channels.
Well, even the mainstream media is covering a lot of the atrocities.
Oh, it's covering what?
The atrocities.
Yes, it is. Now, belatedly, it is recovering it. And I notice the BBC has changed its tone somewhat. But I heard a broadcast on the radio this morning the Today programme, and the interviewer of a Miss Usher in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, he didn't ask the questions. She talked about defeating Hamas. Hamas is a government and resistance movement which got 43% of the popular vote in 2006. So we're talking about defeating a government, not a resistance movement.
On another attack completely, here in Britain, there seems to be an enormous push right now for assisted dying. I wonder, as a doctor, how do you feel about being asked to kill one of your patients?
I've attended a good many people whose life is ebbing, and I'm quite certain that this bill, interestingly tabled by the sister of Joe Cox, a rather hard-eyed young lady who I would not trust further than I could throw her. And the whole thing is to do with a lack of respect for the sanctity of life and a willingness not to care for people when they are dying or possibly dying.
People, I mean, this is people's own will, isn't it? So if you, as a doctor, are presented with a certificate saying this person, and it's all properly signed by one doctor, maybe, I don't know what the procedure is, they seem to be diluting that the whole time. Would you kill a patient if it was their wish?
No, but I have, in fact, prescribed morphine, or actually given morphine, to people whose life has almost ended, and to ease their pain, and to ease the pain in their mind, they have had that which is named after the god of sleep, Morpheus, and that's a rather wonderful drug from opium, purified from opium, and heroin even more so. But what it's all about is, in fact, that basic Mosaic principle, love thy neighbour. And all that you do is to use all your professional skill and the warmth of your heart to help people in their final hours. And you do not assist dying deliberately with the patient agreeing to that. There's an excellent letter among about four or five showing just how interested doctors are in the whole bill and in how the BMJ presents these things by my dear friend Janet Menage. She wrote a very, as usual, a cogent letter to the BMJ. It's in the rapid responses column, and she lists the various reasons why the assisted dying campaign is wrong fundamentally. And I've seen it very close hand. My dear friend Joe Clark Irons, her partner, died 6 months ago. He had the most abysmal care in our NHS, in his final days at home. He died at home. He was in pain. One day he had to wait for 5 hours on a Saturday from about, I think, 3 p.m. in the afternoon. I'm not sure why he was in severe pain, but he was a very brave man. I'm sure his pain was real. He had to wait for the night team of district nurses to come on at 8 o'clock before he could have an injection of morphine. He never saw his GP in his final days. In fact, he didn't see his GP for weeks. And yet he had congestive heart failure, and he had pain, I think, from some tumour which had not been diagnosed. And I saw, just in that one case, the absolutely, the fact that we've gone backwards, that we used to have end-of-life care in college hospitals. They've closed 70% of the beds of those, so now we have the ambulances backing up in the hospitals, and we have people dying without proper care.
Well, sick people are not economically productive,
exactly,
are they?
No, no. The sooner they're out, the better. You can see that these people, they're the idea that life is sacred is not in their minds. They regard the whole thing as a, well, as numbers partly, but it is that actually. At basis it is, they do not respect the sanctity of life. And that's not just in humans, it's in animals as well. If you think about how we used to export, you know, thousands of animals in crowded ships to the continent and to the Arab world, actually, as well.
Well, and human slaves and in human times slaves. Gone by.
Well, look at that. Look how we treated our Irish brothers across the Irish Sea. Look at the...
and Africans in the triangular trade.
Think
many tens of thousands dying over the years on the way.
On the triangular trade, taking black slaves, negotiated with Arab intermediaries and the chiefs, the African chiefs, a third of them died on the voyage. They were thrown overboard as food for the fish. And they were kept below decks in the most terrible conditions. Awful. And think of North American Indians, 20 million killed systematically. 20 million.
Is there anything that you would advise people who are feeling that they're not getting cared for properly by the National Health Service or, you know, by their GP, etc.? Is there anywhere they can go to seek help where they don't feel that they're getting any service or a good enough service?
I'm not sure, Tony. I'm not sure about that, actually. But you know what does happen? I find all the time I speak to what I call a common man and woman. They understand what's going on. They resist their digital identity attempts, you know, always being asked your date of birth, your postcode, and then, of course, your cell phone number, all part of this obvious campaign to have every one of our 7 billion world citizens all labelled by the people like the Palantir crew. But what it comes down to is, again, neighbourliness, and in fact so many people are helped in their suffering by neighbours. That's true, actually, really.
I would also maybe mention churches. Church support groups can be really helpful.
The churches, religious foundations, Islamic, Christian, what have you. Jewish, no doubt, as well. But what is happening is an obvious... I notice that my wife, Sue, is facing quite a few very serious medical issues, including poor sight and poor balance and burning legs at night. But she has had the most wonderful care from parts of the health service, from physiotherapists. Yesterday she was visited by an occupational therapist, Bernard, and she was given walking aid. She's had walking aids, things like that. So we have seen the best side of our local humanity, and in the hospitals there are some very excellent specialists. There are some wonderful nurses, and we have to cleave to that. There's also some very low standards as well, we know that. But I feel, I'm hopeful, that because people like working in teams, they like the essence of the health service, and they come from other countries because of that to serve in our health service, I'm quite sure that our NHS will be rebuilt. People are seeing the importance of fundamental things, and the fundamental thing is love thy neighbour.
So your website does look at medical issues, policy here in Britain, as well as obviously the situation over in the Middle East. Can you just remind us of whereabouts people can find it again, please?
Yes. With one website devoted to Palestine, which has been refashioned, and it's good. That's doveanddolphin.org. I think that will find it. But my main website, general website, is dhalpin, D-H-A-L-P-I-N dot infoaction, I-N-F-O-A-C-T-I-O-N dot org dot UK. And it's a massive website. There's a large video section with some good videos, including one a talk in Totnes entitled Zionism, Dr. David Kelly and the BBC, and they are connected. But on my website, which I just referred you to, if you put in the word vortex sucks, there's a second address to the Alternative View meeting. That was actually at Heathrow Airport. There were about 350 people there. And it was I followed Gerrish, and then I was followed by Dr. Professor Bellamy, who was then silenced because he was then, in fact, very sceptical about the climate change nonsense. But that talk, The Vortex Sucks, is on my website, if you just put in Vortex. And I haven't reread it just this morning. It's a very good summary of what is happening in our world today. I discuss what got the Nazi regime going. And it's the same thing now. The four elements was fear, the Reichstag fire, which was a setup, as you know. They blamed it on the communists, so they then, in fact, could corral the socialists and communists in Germany and later kill them. God, we talked about God last night. I mean, you're talking about God in a sort of generic sense. Patriotism, that's being flogged here like bilio. As in the last VE Day celebration. And the last thing is racism. And that was why the Havana Agreement in about 1936 between the talk between the Nazi regime and the Zionists, the common factor there was racial supremacy. So that's why the Nazis had some empathy with the growing Zionist influence, because both had racial superiority in their so-called ideology.
Okay, Dr. David Halpin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you too, Tony, very much for interviewing me.